This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, we feature two guests with ties to the fishing industry, one who writes about it and one who works in it. 40 years ago, almost all the fish we consumed was caught in the wild. Today, nearly half is raised in fish farms. So eating fish has become kind of complicated. Between worrying that there may be toxins in the fish and concerns that the way the fish is farmed or captured may be bad for the water's ecosystem. Our first guest today, author Paul Greenberg, warns that in natural ecosystems, we've removed more wild fish than can be replaced by natural processes. In his book, For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, now out in paperback, Greenberg looks at what's happened to salmon, sea bass, cod, and tuna. These are four fish, he says, humanity is trying to master, whether through the management of a wild system, domestication and farming of individual species, or the outright substitution of one species for another. Paul Greenberg has written about fish and the oceans for the New York Times. He spoke with Terry Gross last year.
So let's take a look at salmon. What does salmon represent in the larger picture that you're looking at, how fish have changed and how humans consume and farm fish have changed?
Yeah, well, you know, gradually with the way humans have used fish, we've started inland and moved further and further offshore. And salmon represent that first step with fish that, you know, salmon spawn in freshwater rivers. They're nearby, and we have very close, intimate interaction with them right where we live. So they were one of the first fish that we really hit hard with industrialization. Dams and pollution and all these different things caused wide-scale extirpation of salmon, particularly Atlantic salmon, throughout their range. And now what we've seen is, you know, salmon was really the first large-scale domestication project that happened with the fish that we eat. There are many more farm salmon in the world than wild salmon, and it's a kind of, you know, replacement of a wild food system with a domestic food system that has started to be a kind of a model moving forward.
So is it mostly the Atlantic that's lost the salmon? Are there still a lot of wild salmon in the Pacific?
Yeah, I mean, there are still pretty strong runs of Pacific salmon, particularly in Alaska and the Russian Far East. But in the Atlantic, basically Atlantic salmon are commercially extinct. And this is a very important thing that consumers need to know. You know, a lot of times when you see salmon in the marketplace, you'll see Scottish salmon, Irish salmon, or even Nova salmon. I think, you know, probably you grew up eating Nova lox, for example, right? You know, that was lox from Nova Scotia.
Yes.
Well, today, right, you know, today all those fish are farmed. You know, there is almost no wild Atlantic salmon left in the Atlantic. I mean, I've heard the number at something like 500,000 fish total. So what we've essentially done is we've replaced an extremely productive and, you know, calorie-rich and highly nutritious food system, wild food system, with a domesticated one. And that began in the late 1960s, and it's been probably the driver in changing the way we're taming the sea.
Let's talk about how salmon are farmed.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you use the word captive when describing salmon, and I never thought of farmed fish as captives. I always had this image of, like, fish swimming around this kind of, like, fenced-off part of the sea.
Home in the range, right?
Yeah, so, like, okay, they couldn't venture far, but they could, like, swim around. They have the food brought to them, so they don't have to worry about survival. And you know, of course, they're killed for us to eat, but I never thought of them quite as, like, captive.
Well, yeah. In fact, you know, they're often confined in pretty tight spaces. You know, the technology around modern aquaculture or fish farming, that's what aquaculture is often called scientifically, really developed around salmon. And what they consist of are sort of hoop-shaped cages that are often put up in sort of symmetrical arrays. In Norway, they started doing them in fjords where they were protected from, you know, wave and wind. And same deal in the Bay of Fundy in Canada. And, you know, the fish are pretty crammed in there. And what they'll do is they'll usually start them indoors in tanks when they're still at a very fragile stage. And then what they'll do is they'll transfer them to these large pens. They're, you know, sometimes they're called sea pens or sea cages, where they grow out for a couple of years until they're ready for harvest.
Is there room for them to swim, or are they basically just penned in and sitting there.
No, they can swim. And in fact, you know, for their own health, they have to be able to swim, and they tend to kind of circle around. But you bring up a good point, which is that, you know, the density of salmon is a really big issue in terms of its environmental effects. Keep in mind that most salmon are grown in wild salmon country, right? So if you put a lot of farm salmon confined in cages in a place where migrating wild salmon still exist, there are going to be deleterious effects on the wild population. The fish that are crammed in real tight, you do get outbreaks of disease. There's been a rolling disease called infectious salmon anemia, which causes bleeding in salmon kidneys. There's a huge problem with a parasite called sea lice, which affixes to, you know, it's a naturally occurring parasite. But when you have fish in extreme densities, then the sea lice are drawn in to this sort of, you know, aggregation of food. And there's been some studies that show that sea lice do transfer to the wild populations. And because wild populations of Atlantic salmon are so depressed throughout their range, you know, maybe if there were a lot of wild Atlantic salmon out there, the interaction wouldn't be so bad. But with the numbers being so low as they are right now, anything that knocks them down a peg is a real, real problem. And so, you know, the salmon farming industry has a real issue on its hands with how do they continue to produce product for the market without destroying wild runs of existing Atlantic salmon.
Now, another concern about farmed salmon is what they're fed and how much they have to be fed. What are the concerns?
Well, yeah, this is another big issue about the sort of replacement of a wild food system with a domesticated food system. You know, what do salmon eat? Well, on the farm anyway, what they eat is other fish. And where do those fish come? The wild. So, you know, the global catch right now in the world is 90 million tons, which is a lot of fish. You know, it's equivalent to the human weight of China removed from the sea every year. A third of that is what they call forage fish, herring, anchovies, little things like that. And incidentally, the weight of all those taken from the sea every year would be the equivalent of the human weight of the United States taken out every year. Those are harvested every year. They're made into feed pellets. And in the early days of aquaculture, the early days of salmon aquaculture, the feeding was extremely inefficient. There wasn't a great deal of care making sure that the salmon actually ate what they were fed. So there's a lot of waste. And I think in 2000, the journal Nature published a study that the fish-in, fish-out ratio, in other words, the number of pounds of wild fish that was required to make a pound of salmon, could be as much as 3 pounds of wild fish to make 1 pound of salmon. So right then and there, you're sort of like, well, that's a pretty screwy equation. You know, why are we coming up with a net marine protein loss? But to its credit, you know, the salmon industry took this somewhat seriously, or actually very seriously, and because it's also an economic factor for them because, you know, it's expensive buying all that feed. And over the years, they've instituted a selective breeding program with salmon, mostly in Norway, where they took the 40 original salmon strains in all these different rivers in Norway, and they crossed them and they recrossed them, and they came up eventually with a salmon that required half the feed of its original wild variant. So, you know, you could say that was a positive ecological move that the salmon industry did, but unfortunately the salmon industry keeps growing, so that while per fish efficiency is better, the overall footprint of the salmon industry is just bigger and bigger. So, you know, it's a concern.
So are farmed salmon any more or less healthy than wild salmon?
It's a very, very, very big debate. About 10 years ago, the Pew Environment Group commissioned one of the largest studies ever done, where they tried to figure out, was there any difference between the sort of industrial contaminants, things like that, in farmed salmon than in wild salmon? What they found was that actually, yes, there was. The deal is that wild salmon are actually much more omnivorous than farmed salmon. In the course of a wild salmon's life, they're likely to eat, you know, little crustaceans, sometimes some fish, sometimes, you know, crab here and there. Whereas a farmed salmon only eats fish pretty much, plus whatever soy and corn products are put in there to kind of fill out the fish meal. And it turns out that it's really important where that fish comes from. In the early days of salmon farming, most of the fish meal that was used was Northern Hemisphere fish meal, capelin, herring, mackerel, different things from the Northern Hemisphere. And by and large, you know, the northern hemisphere has higher industrial pollutants than the southern. And with feed and farm salmon, it turns out that there were high concentrations of PCBs in the fish meal that they were being fed. And the contamination in the fish meal gets passed on into the flesh of salmon. It turns out PCBs, you know, they're polychlorobiphenyls, are a very persistent chemical, and they don't wash out of the body very easily. They take many years to for the body to be rid of them. And the same deal is true with salmon. So if a salmon keeps eating fish meal that's contaminated, it will get a higher and higher toxicity, and it will eventually pass that on to humans. So what they found overall, what the Pew study found, was that farm salmon overall had higher levels of PCBs than wild salmon. Keep in mind that this was, close to a decade ago. And since then, the salmon industry has started to look at southern hemisphere feed sources, mostly Peruvian anchoveta, which are caught off of Peru. And the southern hemisphere fish meal has generally lower PCBs than the northern hemisphere fish meal. There hasn't been a large-scale subsequent study since that shift started to occur. So I think the jury is still out. But according to that original Pew study, PCBs were higher in farmed fish than in wild fish.
Before we move on to another fish, what are some of the lessons learned from the way we've farmed salmon that you think should apply to the farming of other fish?
Two things. When you farm a fish in proximity to its wild equivalent, you're taking on considerable risks, and you potentially threaten a viable wild food system. And I truly believe that those things need to be taken into account before any kind of farming is introduced into the open sea. There are some really interesting what are called recirculating aquaculture facilities in development. There's a guy named Jonathan Zohar down at the University of Maryland at Baltimore. I think it's called the Comb Lab, who's literally got a fish farm set up in downtown Baltimore where all the inputs and outputs are controlled, even the waste products are recycled, and it has no negative interaction with the wild. It's energy intensive, but at the same time, it's something that could conceivably reduce the food miles that fish have to travel. You know, if you can grow fish in downtown Baltimore and feed it to Baltimoreans, that's probably a pretty good energy equation. The other thing that came up that I found really interesting, when I was up in New Brunswick, I met a guy named Thierry Chopin, who is doing a project called Integrated Multitrophic Aquaculture, or IMTA. And what that does is to kind of turn the whole equation of monoculture of salmon on its head and say, you know, let's not just grow one single crop. You know, we've learned that with like corn and beef and all that kind of stuff, that monoculture is generally a bad environmental choice. What Terry's doing with IMTA is that he's growing salmon, mussels, sea cucumbers, and edible and industrial use algae all in a polyculture. Those different extractive creatures like mussels and sea cucumbers and algae remove waste from the water. It's still a pilot project. It's not scaled up to industrial use, but I'd like to see more of that kind of work happen.
Let's look at cod. What does cod represent in the big picture that you're writing about?
Well, as I said before, the exploitation of the sea starts inshore and moves further and further offshore. And what cod represents is this sort of epic industrial move to the continental shelves where, you know, beginning around the Middle Ages, huge aggregations of cod were found first off of Europe. But then people like Mark Kurlansky would posit that that's what brought the Vikings to the New World in the first place, were these huge, epically large amounts of cod on the Grand Banks in Canada and then the George's Bank off of Massachusetts. So, and they really represent the sort of industrialization of fishing. If all that cod had never been found, I don't think we'd have a fish stick today. And, you know, it's the sort of reimagining of fish, not just as this sort of local artisanal product, but as this mass scale industrial thing that fills up our supermarkets and our fast food restaurants.
So once cod started being used for fish sticks and all the fish stuff in the fast food restaurants and the frozen food sections, mm-hmm. How did that affect the fish, the cod itself?
Well, what it did was cause a huge buildup in what's called fishing effort, just bigger and bigger boats, more and more nets in the water, bigger and bigger technology. Because keep in mind, the real big buildup that happened in fishing was post-World War II, you know, when all this new technology, you know, sonar for finding submarines turned, you know, was easily repurposed, sonar to find cod. All these polymers, you know, were turned into, you know, huge nets and things that allowed us to just catch many, many more fish. And what we saw was, you know, the destruction of two of the greatest fishing grounds the world has ever seen, the Grand Banks off Canada, closed in the, I think, late 80s, early 90s, and then large chunks of Georges Bank closed to fishing in 1994. And we've been sort of waiting ever since, trying to see, is cod going to come back? And if not, what else can we find out there to fill our supermarkets?
So is there no more cod left, or is it just a different type of cod that's available now?
Well, no. You know, first of all, when talking about the ocean, a lot of people try to reframe things in the terms of the land, and they say, you know, cod is extinct, bluefin tuna are extinct. What we're talking about here is really the loss of abundance, right? They're probably, you know, even on the Grand Banks, they're probably on the order of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of cod still left. But they are what is called commercially extinct. In other words, the effort it requires to catch those fish isn't really worth the amount of money you can sell those fish at market. So the Grand Banks is still in pretty bad shape. It's not really showing very good signs of rebuilding. In America, on Georges Bank and in the Gulf of Maine, those are, you know, two different separate populations of cod. We are seeing some gradual rebuilding. The Gulf of Maine, according to the Fisheries Service, is 50% rebuilt, although, you know, that has some controversy attached to it. We also, there are Pacific species of cod, which are still pretty common, a lot of it caught in Alaska. And there's still a couple of populations of cod that are, you know, commercially viable. There's a big population in Scandinavia called the scry or wandering cod. And Iceland also has pretty good healthy cod stocks at this point.
In your chapter about cod, you write about tilapia, a.k.a. St. Peter's fish, which is farmed and is easy to farm. And you describe it as a good example of a fish that works in an industrialized setting. Well, is tilapia relatively new to American fish markets? I don't remember it from when I was young.
Yeah, it's completely new. What happened with tilapia, it's kind of an interesting story. Some early work was done in Israel. Israel's a very early aquaculturist. But it was also something that people in the Peace Corps really embraced because they found that tilapia, it's one of these things where you can just throw it in a pond and it'll eat whatever's in there and it grows and it doesn't require too much effort. So it was this kind of like perfect development fish that you could introduce into ponds throughout the developing world. It was a good way of getting protein. Actually, coincidentally with the crash of Georges Bank cod and Grand Banks cod, is that tilapia culture started getting serious, particularly in Latin America. And a lot of former Peace Corps volunteers who, you know, became businessmen sort of said, well, let's try and turn this fish into something that works for a Western market. And it really started to kind of get going in the late 90s. And it, you know, now I think it's the fifth most popular fish in America.
So if you eat a lot of tilapia, farmed tilapia, is that considered a healthy fish?
Tilapia, because they don't eat a lot of fish meal, they don't have the omega-3 profile that, you know, so many nutritionists say we should be having. That said, as a form of protein, it's better, I think, to eat a low-fat fillet, you know, a sustainably raised fish, than a big chunk of beef or even pork or chicken. It's just leaner. There are some concerns. Tilapia has something called an omega-6 in it. And frankly, I haven't gone too far into the health aspects on that one. But I've gotten a few emails from nutritionists that say that there are some potential ancillary health problems with eating too many omega-6, having to do with inflammation of tissue and things like that. But overall, you know, I eat tilapia. I think it's a better, you know, in the profile of food that we have out to eat out there, I think it's certainly a better choice than beef.
So let me sum up what we've just learned. You've basically told us that salmon are farmed in ways that are probably not environmentally great, that they may have PCBs. They did about a decade ago. We're not sure now. So it's a kind of discouraging picture. But tilapia, which are farmed in much more environmentally correct ways with better food and they're not as healthy as salmon. So what am I supposed to do when I'm ordering? If I order the salmon, then I feel really bad because of the poor ways that most salmon are farmed. If I order the tilapia, I'm not getting the benefits of omega-3.
Yeah. First of all, I think this is the problem with the kind of paring down of fish markets down to these sort of four basic fish? You know, the answer might be sort of none of the above. And I'd go back to, like, if you want to eat something that's healthy and not damaging to the environment, you know, smaller fish like herring, like mackerel, anchovies, sardines, those are all really good, nutritious kinds of things that have a good omega-3 profile. They're not the kinds of things that we're accustomed to eating. You know, like, I think Americans in general don't like too fishy a fish, but we might need to kind of readjust to that and kind of start to embrace fish that are smaller and, you know, easier on the environment. As far as, you know, tilapia are concerned, I mean, listen, we eat all sorts of unhealthy stuff, right? We shouldn't be eating as much beef, right? We shouldn't be eating as much chicken, probably. You know, Mark Bittman, who I've been having these endless back and forth about, you know, whether we should farm fish or not, he's saying, well, we should just be eating less of everything. We should be eating less meats and more vegetables. Same thing is true of fish. Let's eat wild salmon, but if we're going to eat it, let's eat it sparingly because there's not a lot of it. You know, there are still very healthy runs of Pacific salmon out there, but, you know, not enough so that the whole world can have a huge chunk of it every day, but a little bit every week, it's not a bad thing to do.
Let's take a look at tuna. What do they represent in the big picture that you're writing about?
Tuna are really the last wild fish gold rush that's going on right now. Tuna often live in what are called the high seas, the international waters that are owned by nobody and fished by everybody. Bluefin tuna cross the Atlantic and the Pacific. So do yellowfin and albacore are quite far-ranging as well. So they're really the wildest of fish that we have out there. And the sushi binge that's happened over the last 20 years is having a serious effect on them. And so I guess they represent fish, you know, whether they should be seafood or wildlife. And I think they're at the heart of that debate right now.
What do you mean by the difference between seafood and wildlife?
Well, you know, seafood is one of my favorite and most hated words. I mean, when you think about it, what a cruel word. And it's consistent language to language. Europeans call seafood, you know, sea fruit, frutti di mare. Russians, I think, say dari more, which, you know, gifts of the sea. So this is sort of generic thing. Like, there's all this stuff down there, and we just kind of pull it up, and we sort of parse it and figure out what's good and throw the rest overboard, and we eat it. But meanwhile, you know, these creatures are wildlife. You know, these are wild animals that have incredible life cycles. You know, bluefin tuna can be 12, 14 feet long, 1,500 pounds. They can swim up to 40 miles an hour. They have organs in their head that act as both a sextant and as a compass. You know, they're incredible, incredible animals. And yet, you know, we generally think of them as sushi. So, you know, that, I think, is something that really needs to be reevaluated at this point. And we have to figure out, you know, what does work as food and what is better left as an animal. And, you know, tuna, particularly Atlantic bluefin tuna, may be the thing that we should think of more as wildlife than food.
Now, the tuna swim through international water. So what problems does that pose in terms of regulating the fishing of tuna?
The problem it poses is that there's no really hard, fast way to regulate them. I mean, there are what are called, there's 18 regional fisheries management organizations that are kind of like these little United Nations that sit down and kind of hash out, you know, who's going to get what from all the tuna. But a lot of times the negotiations around tuna are built around sort of political compromises that, you know, while there are scientific committees that say you shouldn't take more than this much, a lot of times they'll just sort of say, well, you know, you know, Ivory Coast wants more yellowfins, and, you know, but they'll swap us this for that. And you end up with these kind of quotas that are not really scientifically based. You know, the most famous thing of that was that 2 years ago, the committee that oversees bluefin tuna, Atlantic bluefin, set a quota at nearly double what scientists on the scientific committee were saying was the threshold for a catch. So you ended up, you know, where the population went down, and it's now kind of at a crisis point. And whereas bluefin are kind of the tip of the iceberg, there are all these other tuna species below them that are still in reasonably good shape but are the kind of next thing on the chopping block should we go through our bluefin.
Now, a lot of people say we shouldn't even be eating big fish like tuna because it's not healthy. What are the problems?
The bigger fish, the bigger tuna, there is a mercury issue that happens. Just like PCBs, mercury does something called bioaccumulation. Mercury contamination levels get more intense the higher you go up the food chain. And tuna are, you know, at the top of the food chain, so they have the highest mercury levels. It varies from species to species, but certainly bluefin have a mercury risk. That's the main thing to watch out for. Also, some people say that, you know, again, tuna are a fattier fish, again, particularly bluefin. And if the benefit we're looking for in fish is a leaner kind of meat, then maybe bluefin isn't really where we should be going in the first place.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Greenberg. He's the author of the book For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. I guess, you know, I never really thought of fish as the last wild food until I saw the title of your book.
Yeah. You know, and that's what I think is amazing about the ocean. You know, a lot of the book is there's a fair amount of my going fishing, and that's how I first encountered fish. I never bought seafood. I always caught it. And so for me, it was always wild. That consumers have become so detached from it that they don't even really think of it as wild is disturbing to me. A lot of people I know, you know, perfectly intelligent, college-educated people, if I mention a fish to them, they can't even really say what it looks like or how big it is or, you know, what it does in the wild. So I kind of think that moving forward, you know, I'm not saying that we should stop fishing or that we shouldn't have this wild food. Quite the contrary. I think it's a beautiful thing to have abundant wild food in our lives. When you think about what happened on the Great Plains, before American colonists arrived, there were somewhere in the order of probably 60 million bison. And today there are, you know, about 100 million head of cattle. So we basically replaced a functioning wild food system with a domesticated one that has all sorts of environmental repercussions and all sorts of costs associated with it. Where we stand right now with fish is, you know, as I said earlier, 50% of our seafood is now farmed. We could end up replacing a very good and beautiful and functional wild food system with an expensive, potentially environmentally degrading farmed food system. And I don't want that to happen. I want there to be wild food. I think there has to be some farmed fish as well, but we need to figure out a way to farm it in a way that does not affect wild populations.
Well, Paul Greenberg, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Terry. It was a lot of fun.
Paul Greenberg, speaking with Terry Gross last year. His book, For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, is now out in paperback. This is Fresh Air.
Andrea Gale, do you read me? Do you read me? Come in! Come in, for God's sake, come in! Billy, these storms have collided! They are exploding!
That's Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio in the movie The Perfect Storm, playing our next guest, fishing boat captain Linda Greenlaw. She says her actual radio conversation with Captain Billy Tyne in 1991, believed to be the final contact made with the Andrea Gale before it disappeared in a storm, was less dramatic than the Hollywood version. But Greenlaw is a real commercial fisherman and the only female swordboat captain in the country. Sword fishing doesn't involve nets and trawling. During each fishing venture, Greenlaw and her crew will set thousands of individual hooks on a line and haul the massive creatures aboard one at a time. After years on the sea, Greenlaw left deep water fishing for 10 years to set lobster traps and write books. Her first, The Hungry Ocean, became a bestseller, and she's written 5 more books of fiction and nonfiction. Last year, she returned to the deep water, and that voyage is the subject of her latest book. It's called Seaworthy, A Swordboat Captain Returns to the Sea, and it's now out in paperback. Linda Greenlaw spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last year.
Linda Greenlaw, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, in this book, you write, the position of skipper aboard a U.S. Grand Banks longline vessel is the absolute pinnacle of the commercial fishing world. And I'd like you to begin by just telling us what longline deep water sword fishing is, how it works.
Well, longlining is, as the name would suggest, the fishery itself is fishing a very long line. A typical set, which we do every night while we're at sea, is 40 miles. We lay out a 40-mile single strand of 1,000-pound test line onto which we attach about 1,000 baited hooks. And that attachment's called a leader. It's suspended basically fairly close to the surface. And we fish temperature breaks, for instance, east of the Grand Banks, which is where most of my experience is. We fish where the Gulf Stream, which is to the south, pushes up into the Labrador Current, which is cold water. These temperature breaks are where all the feed collects and where there's prey, there should be a predator. That's where we fish.
Okay. And so every day you have this big spool on the deck, and you just roll out 40 miles of line, and you have floats every so often, right, which I guess allow you to retrieve these things later. And you leave these 40 miles and 1,000 baited leader hooks out for several hours and then reel them in the next day, right?
Yes, that's correct. And swordfish are nocturnal in that they feed at night. They come close to the surface to feed at night. So we set the line out in the evening, and at daylight we pick up the end of the 40-mile string and start hauling it back.
Okay. So now you got this crew of, you know, I guess 5 or 6 people on a boat that I guess in the case of the Seahawk, which you most recently were on, was like about, what, 63 feet?
Yes, 63-foot boat, right. And I had a crew of 5 men.
Right. So you have 5 people that are baiting 1,000 hooks a day, reeling them out. And then when you reel them back in, explain the process there and what you do when you have a swordfish or some other kind of fish on it.
Okay, well, hauling the gear back, it's all hands on deck, including the captain, and that's my favorite part of the job is hauling the gear, because it's just like Christmas, you know, can't wait to see what you're going to get. Tie into the end in the morning and start hauling it. The captain drives the boat along the line, kind of following these floats, as you mentioned, and when the line gets tight or you feel some strain on it, that means you have some weight on a hook. You back the boat down, stop the boat, hopefully, and see what you have. It comes to a point when the snap, or the thing that connects the hook to the main line, when that breaks the surface, it's hand over hand hauling, one man against one fish. And you hope it's a swordfish. Sometimes it's a shark, sometimes it's a tuna, sometimes it's mahi-mahi. But the target is swordfish. That's what we're all praying for.
And you can tell when it's a swordfish, right?
I can, yeah. I've been doing this a long time. I started sword fishing at the age of 19, so basically I'm not fooled much. When there's a little weight on the line, a swordfish acts totally different than a tuna or a shark.
Well, talk about that. How does a swordfish act?
A swordfish generally is pulling straight down, and when it gets close to the surface, it starts doing these circles. We call it a death circle, or we hope it's going to be a death circle and not a release circle. Tuna fish, often if you have the line in your hand, you feel a pump, pump, pump when it's pumping its tail, and you can really feel that if you have the line running through your hand. A shark generally does not dive down. It comes up to the surface, so the leader would be stretched out on the surface, and quite often you'd see a fin breaking the surface.
Now you got to get this thing aboard the boat, and I know from reading your book that there's a break in the gunwale, I mean the side of the ship, right? In effect, a door, right, where you can haul this. But it's still, you're talking about a 100-pound fish, right?
Yes. I mean, you're hoping it's a 100-pound fish. Last season, we had a 171-pound average. These are big fish. And yes, there's a door cut in the side of the boat to make it a little easier to get the fish aboard. Basically, once the fish breaks the surface, you put gaffs in the fish to help pull it aboard. If it's a gigantic fish, we have a hydraulic lift that we can put a strap around the tail and pull the fish aboard that way.
Then what happens?
Once the fish is aboard the boat, the fish cleaner goes to work. It's very important for us to keep the quality of the fish really to high standards to get the money that we need to get for the fish to make a living. So the fish needs to be cleaned. That means, you know, the head comes off, the guts come out, salt water, rinse, and it gets packed on salt water ice immediately. Really important to get the fish chilled really quickly and not leave the fish on deck.
So every day, assuming that the weather is decent and things are working, you are reeling out 40 miles of long line, baiting 1,000 hooks, pulling in those 1,000 hooks the next day, and then preparing to put them back out the next morning. It must be incredibly strenuous and sleep depriving.
Sleep deprivation is a big part of the swordfish industry. We're lucky if we get 4 hours a night. You know, the days get long, you know, depending on weather, of course, is the biggest factor. If you're trying to haul the gear in bad weather, it just takes a little bit longer. Every fish, you know, that you stop to bring aboard, a little more difficult to get aboard in bad weather. Part-offs are a huge factor in the length of a day.
It's where the line gets cut, right?
Yes. If you're hauling back the line and you have 2 or 3 or 5 part-offs in a day, each time you have to chase the end, it's time-consuming. A captain can make a bad set and catch a lot of sharks. Very time-consuming. So, yeah, the long days, you know, you're lucky if you get 4 hours sleep.
And how long does a trip last?
We generally keep our trips in sync with the lunar cycle. So a trip is, you know, 28 to 30 days, and that's the goal, is to keep on the lunar cycle, because the fishing is better because you're fishing these temperature breaks, and The moon obviously affects tide. I guess everyone's aware of that. But these temperature breaks are more defined from the first quarter through the full moon. So we try and do our steaming back and forth to the dock and our turnaround or our time at the dock, unloading, resupplying during the new moon or when you can't see any moon, and our fishing during when you can see a moon.
So you're typically at sea for about a month?
Yes, a typical trip is 30 days.
So when you're reeling in the line, these 1,000 baited leaders, how many swordfish will you typically get?
Oh, the success of a trip just varies so much. I've never been skunked. That means I've never been fishless at the end of a haul back. My biggest day was 107 fish. That's huge. Over 10,000 pounds of fish in one day. If you can average, 3,000 pounds a night, 30 fish, that's a good way to put a trip together. It's a grind. You're going to make 10 or 12 or 20 sets, whatever you need to do to get enough fish to go in with without sort of overdoing the moon thing. You don't want to miss the next moon, so you can't stay out too long, and you don't want your fish to be too old. So, 3,000 pounds a night is a pretty good average.
So, 1,000 hooks, 30 fish, and do it again the next day.
Exactly.
Right, so here you are. I mean, you're at very close quarters, working long hours with five or six other people, and you are a woman, which is rare in the business, right?
Yes, it is rare in the business.
I know from reading about you that you started sword fishing, I guess, when you were in college. And I'm just kind of curious, what was it like being a woman at sea? Was it different? Was it difficult?
I fell in love with fishing at the age of 19. I love what I do. And honestly, gender has not been an issue. I started on deck. I worked very hard, had an opportunity to run a boat, came up in the traditional way. I stayed on a boat long enough to become first mate. The owner of the boat bought a second boat. That was my opportunity to become captain. Worked very hard, eventually got good at it. I hire my own crew. A lot of questions are about, men working for a woman. I hire my own guys. Any man that doesn't want to go to sea with a woman hopefully won't ask me for a job. And that's not to say I've never had crew problems, because I have, but they haven't been as a result of my being a woman. Everyone has crew problems at one time or another.
I'd like you to tell one story that you relate in the book about a case where you saw a swordfish take on a shark.
Early in my sword fishing career, we fished on George's Banks, and part of the fishery that we were doing was harpooning, which is the most incredibly fun and exciting fishery. It's a sight fishery. My part of that was being the helmsman. I climb up the mast, I'm in the crow's nest, I'm driving the boat from up there and looking for fish swimming on the surface of the ocean. It's one fish. You're not seeing schools of fish. You're looking around for a single fish. Well, this particular day, I was up in the crow's nest. I saw fins. And I was like, wow, all right, cool. I put the boat in gear, and the captain's running out to the end of the stand or the pulpit from where you throw the harpoon. And as we approach the fins, which kept disappearing, I noticed that there were two sets of fins. One set of fins was a swordfish and a big one. And the second set of fins was a gigantic mako shark. Well, we watched a struggle between a mako shark and a swordfish. And the captain of the boat is wanting me to get the boat onto the mako shark so we can harpoon the shark, or the swordfish so we can harpoon the swordfish. We get up to the shark, harpoon it, and then look around for the fish. The fish is gone. And, of course, we're very disappointed. The fish is gone. A little while later, the fins pop up. Bang. Nope, we miss it. Fish is gone. So we missed a big fish. It was a huge fish. It was really a day saver. We really needed that fish. So we haul back the shark, get the shark on the deck. It's a big mako. And the guy cleaning the shark is just amazed at this little tiny baby swordfish that was in the shark's belly. And suddenly I felt okay about this big swordfish getting away, because I had a feeling that the swordfish and the shark were fighting or, struggling together. The swordfish was upset. I mean, the shark ate the swordfish's baby. So I felt good about killing the shark, and I felt kind of okay about the swordfish getting away.
Linda Greenlaw, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Linda Greenlaw, speaking with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last year. Her book, Seaworthy, A Swordboat Captain Returns to the Sea, is now out in paperback. And she's also written a cookbook with her mother, Martha Greenlaw. It's called The Maine Summers Cookbook. The two biggest film openings of the week feature shape-shifting robots from outer space, Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts. Hanks and Roberts star in Larry Crown, which Hanks also directs. Transformers: Dark of the Moon is the third feature directed by Michael Bay and based on a line of Hasbro toys. Bay is known for such big-budget action films as Armageddon, The Rock, and Pearl Harbor. Film critic David Edelstein reviews both films.
The July 4th weekend brings textbook Hollywood counter-programming. On one side of the multiplex, you'll find the teen male-oriented blockbuster franchise sequel Transformers: Dark of the Moon, in which giant mutating robots put their fists through one another amid crumbling skyscrapers. Over in the non-3D wing is the quiet grown-up comedy Larry Crown, in which 50-something Tom Hanks, as a laid-off megastore manager, sorta almost romances 40-something Julia Roberts as his married community college professor. The choice is stark, but I think both movies give a surprising amount of pleasure. What? You like a movie by Michael Bay? Yes, though Bay does make it easy to hate him. He's a trophy director. The hottest actresses, the hottest cars, the hottest cars that transform into the hottest robots thanks to the hottest effects. The second Transformers movie was an overblown hash. But this one, once you get past Bay's trademark sexism and gigantism, is a stupendous piece of blockbusting. There's a lot of plot, but it comes down to the bad Transformers, the Decepticons from the planet Cybertron, attempting to enslave the population of Earth, hitherto protected by the good Transformers, the Autobots, led by Optimus Prime, friend to Earthling Sam Witwicky, played by Shia LaBeouf. It takes a while to get oriented. The simplest dialogue scenes are confusing because Bay shoots nothing simply. And he'll rub some folks the wrong way by introducing his new leading lady, lingerie model Rosie Huntington-Whiteley, via the backs of her thighs. But once the humans and Autobots go up against the Decepticons in a devastated Chicago, the movie is like War of the Worlds on steroids. The vistas induce vertigo, and as the camera plunges after our paratrooper heroes down massive skyscrapers toward robots mashing one another's heads and a giant Decepticon octopus with incinerating tentacles, you'll feel the elating transformative power of Hollywood money. Larry Crown is low-tech, its characters human-scaled. Tom Hanks wrote it with Nia Vardalos, whose My Big Fat Greek Wedding he produced with his wife, Rita Wilson. It's a family affair, and the movie is about family, warm surrogate families in a cold capitalist climate. Hanks's Larry Crown has been laid off from a big box store because he never went to college. He spent 20 years as a Navy cook and can't advance. So he enrolls in a public speaking course taught by Julia Roberts's bitter, brittle Mercedes Tenneau, who's getting fed up with the internet porn habit of her indolent husband, played by Breaking Bad's Bryan Cranston with a full head of hair. When Larry pulls up beside her car on his vintage scooter, he leans over her and does what her husband can't.
It's Larry Crown.
Right, hi.
I have you for speech 217 in just a couple of minutes.
Yes, you do.
I saw you singing.
Oh, I'm just drowning out the GPS.
Please enter.
See? It never stops.
Well, no wonder. That's a map genie. Back when I sold you such things, I would have steered you toward a vortex, because the map genie has... It's very complicated. Well, no wonder the auto-on feature is engaged. So, menu, select, features, auto, voice select, change, yes, on, off, off, change, yes, save, and back, and exit.
Oh.
How long was that broken?
Ever since my husband installed it himself.
Well, it's all fixed now.
Thank you.
What are you going to make us do today in class, hmm?
You'll just have to find out.
Follow me.
Interesting.
That interesting is interesting, because as Hanks plays him, Larry isn't especially interesting. I'm almost sorry he directed Larry Crown, since he's so self-effacing. Another director might have pushed him to be faster on the draw, less blandly accepting. But the movie does have a generous feel, happy and bustling and multicultural. The message is explicit. Capitalism can be cutthroat, but you can stay afloat and not hurt others. Larry's second college course is economics, taught by the hamily stentorian George Takei, who helps him figure out how to get by on what he earns. His friends live lightly in supportive communities, among them Cedric the Entertainer as a neighbor with an ongoing lawn sale, and a vivacious actress named Gugu Mbatha-Raw as a fellow scooter rider who makes it her project to dress Larry better and then opens her own secondhand store. It's very cozy. And how badly off can Larry be with Julia Roberts, always and forever a movie star, coming to dinner? But Roberts is wonderful, as she often is, playing characters for whom that wide Julia smile comes hard. There's something fitting about Larry Crown and Transformers opening July 4th weekend. Both are about threats to American decency, Decepticons, heartless employers, and people who make war or cultivate inner peace to keep from being enslaved.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.